is Becky Gannon, and I'm mad about miniatures. Today, we're going tiny. Really, really tiny. With Julie, whose Instagram name, Ridiculously Tiny Things, says it all. Whether she's building, knitting, crocheting, etc., you can bet it's going to be mind-blowingly small. Let's go talk to Julie. Hello, Julie. It's so nice to have you on the show.
Hi, Becky. Thanks for having me. It's so nice to talk to you.
It's nice to talk to you, too. So just so everyone knows, last summer, we ended up being roommates at IGMA-GILT School.
That was so much fun.
We didn't know we were going to be roommates. I didn't even know who my roommate was. I just knew that almost everyone had come to GILT School. Julie was late, and she kept saying, I'm late, I'm late. And the later she was, the happier I got in a way, because no one showed up to be my roommate. And I started thinking, I think Julie's going to be my roommate.
It was so fantastic.
I love your Instagram name because it so perfectly encapsulates what you make and how you view it. And that is Ridiculously Tiny Things. The things you make are indeed ridiculously, joyfully, wonderfully tiny.
Aw, thanks so much. I really do. Yeah, love that silliness aspect of the whole process.
Well, it brings us joy. When we were roommates, I remember at one point you told me you'd brought your little tiny bears, which I don't believe you'd made, but you'd made little tiny sweaters for these incredibly itty-bitty bears. And you brought them down to the build. It just brought such joy, you know, to see someone else's craft and to share it.
Isn't there something so captivating about that? When you see something so nicely made by someone's hand, that it just draws you right in. And I loved that magic that happened when everybody wanted to hold them. And it was just a small collection of bears from my larger collection that I had brought, you know, like a kid going to school with a stuffed animal. I felt like that at GILT School, but it was something that was really well appreciated by all the other miniatures.
It is. There's nothing like show and tell, even as a grown-up, I guess.
That's exactly what it was. That's a great metaphor.
It was. It was like show and tell, just, you know, kind of high-end artisan made show and tell.
Correct. Right. Come see my bears from around the world that you can hold in the palm of your hand.
Exactly. And tell us how tiny, just so people know, how tiny are these bears?
So most of them are about 2 to 3 inches tall, but there are a few that are smaller than a penny. So down to about 1.5 centimeters.
And you have pretty much knitted sweaters for all of them, at least all the ones I saw.
It seems to be a personal challenge that for every bear I get, I'm like, can I knit it a sweater? There are a few fantastic bear artists out there who make such tiny little bears, and those are still waiting for their wardrobe.
So when you knit these tiny sweaters, tell us what you use. Obviously, you don't use regular knitting needles.
Right. I use very fine steel needles. Generally, I'm knitting on needles that are less than 1 millimeter in diameter. So most of them are about 0.7 millimeters or sometimes 0.5, half of a millimeter. And then I use thread. So I use a variety of sewing threads and embroidery threads, including very fine silk sewing thread to knit on these needles with.
And how long are they?
I'd say about 5 inches. A lot of people think that you would knit on pins, like sewing pins, and those are too short to manipulate with your hands. So there's enough length for me to hold them and to spread the stitches out on them and see what I'm doing. But it's the diameter that really counts to make the knitting fine.
That makes more sense. And so you can't use any kind of yarn. It really has to be like really fine thread.
As you know, when you're making miniatures, that the materials really matter. And when you have materials that are kind of thick and clunky, it's going to leave the finished product feeling thick and heavy. And that's really the case with fabric, which behaves very differently in miniature than it does in full scale. When you look at a dollhouse or a miniature scene, if there's any fabric in it, that often is the tell that it's not a full scale scene, because fabric flies away. It looks like it's too stiff and flying away. So getting that fabric to be fine and drape properly is one of the big challenges of fine knitwear.
With some of my friends who make leather sofas, they always say the cheap synthetic leather is the best because it's thinner and it more approximates what leather would be like in that scale.
That makes so much sense.
Doesn't it? For me, it was brought home the first time I made a couch. I measured everything, but I didn't take into account that I, you know, had to wrap each thing, the additional diameter of all that wrapping. And it really wasn't that much, but it made a huge difference.
Yes, things get thick and bulky.
Yes.
Because the material themselves has depth.
Yes, yeah. It was kind of a thick fabric anyway. And by the time I wrapped, you know, the end piece and then another end piece and then the back, and then I think the couch had sort of grown from maybe a little big to 1/112 to, like, you know, big for Barbie.
You've just nailed, yeah, the problem with anything tiny in fabric. And now imagine that too on a sweater with seams, that you don't just have the width of the fabric for the sleeve itself, but you also have the little edge of the fabric where that sleeve joins the body and how it can get really thick and bulky really quickly. So you have to kind of design it in a way to reduce that thickness, the exact same as on your couch.
Now, you create your own patterns a lot of times, right?
I do, yeah.
Now, I've seen some of your sketches, and it looks like there's a fair amount of math.
You know, there's always people who say that, you know, they don't use the math they learned in high school and they wish they knew they would never use it when they studied it. But I say anybody who says they don't use high school math is obviously not knitting in miniature, because I use all of it.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it's really incredible. So do you have a favorite thread or like a secret thread that you're willing to share with us?
Yeah, I encourage anyone who wants to do miniature knitting to go to embroidery shops and sewing stores and try all the threads. I have a local one, Rittenhouse Needlepoint in Philadelphia, where I live, and they have so many beautiful embroidery threads, and I'm always buying samples and swatches to try and see how the fabric will work, because what works for one pattern might not work for another one. I did one that was cables, and that's needs a slightly bulkier thread versus one that has fine color work. But one of my favorites is a silk made in France. It's called Overa Soie. It's pretty commonly available, and it comes in about roughly a million colors. And so it's really nice to color match whatever you're trying to imitate.
Oh, that's nice. Now, what is the tiniest sweater that you've knitted?
Oh, it would have been for one of the bears or the little bunny. There's a bear that carries a little bunny.
Yes!
Bunny has...
We will share that pic. You brought that, and I remember just my mouth dropping open.
It's got a button on the front of it, and there's barely enough stitches behind it to hold that button in place, to hold it closed around the surface of it. But yeah, so that one's probably a centimeter tall and wide. But most of them are in 1/12 scale, and then I've done some that are small enough for like a child, an infant size in 1/12 scale, or for an adult in 1/24 scale.
I was thinking last night about the questions I was going to ask you. I was thinking of that tale, you know, the emperor has no clothes.
Uh-huh.
And at some point, I think you could just get a really, like, just say, here's my tiny bear with a sweater, and just like hold your fingers like a tiny bit apart.
That's what I'm going to do at Kilt School this year.
And just say, see it? See it? Everyone's like, oh, yeah, yeah, I see it.
We could totally do that.
Right? And everyone would just think, well, I can't see it, but obviously it's there.
Everyone else seems to be able to.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking about, because it really does get small. Now, on the bunny carried by the bear, where there was a button, what on earth did you make the button out of?
So I buy the buttons. I found plastic buttons that I order from China, and they're 3 millimeters across. But actually at Guild School, I found a maker who does little metal buttons that are way smaller. And instead of having buttonholes in them, they have a little shank on the back. And they're gorgeous, and they're even smaller than that one. And I haven't gotten up the nerve to try them yet.
Wow, that is a special button, it sounds like. Now, pretty recently, you knitted a little collection of sweaters and applied to become an artisan at the International Guild of Miniature Artisans.
I did. It was so much fun. I have so much respect for the artists who are in the guild and the work that they do, and I love stalking them online and at shows and looking at all that work. And I just thought, you know, could I knit well enough to be accepted in the guild? So, inspired by the guild school in June, I decided to put together my best knitting examples and see if they would be accepted. And I was so proud when they were, and I got my artisan status.
That is really wonderful. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And I loved that collection, and I loved the fashion angle of it too. You kind of recreated some iconic, iconic Dior sweater?
Schiaparelli, also Schiaparelli from the 1920s. Yes.
The black and white bow. We'll show a picture of that. So tell us a little bit about the process. How long does it take to become an artisan? Is there a lot of paperwork?
You can apply end of August or early September is when the deadline is, and they want five examples of your best work. You send the items in to them directly, which I love because it means the judges are handling the work. They're looking at it in real life. There's no chance to, you know, just take a photo from a good angle with good lighting and make your work look any different than it is. And as I was making these sweaters, I was imagining judges, and I don't really know what that judging process is looking like, but I was imagining them turning them inside out and examining my seams. So then when they have the guild show in New Jersey in September, that's when they meet in person and they evaluate the work. And they give you really good feedback, whether or not you're accepted. They give you feedback about things that you could do better. And because it is skilled artisans on the panel, they give really good feedback. Even though I was accepted, they gave some areas for improvement, which I've been thinking about. And it adds to those challenges of how can I further my skill and how can I do this a little bit better the next time?
That's wonderful. Well, what you said about turning it each way, I mean, many of my projects do, in fact, have a good side and a bad side.
And isn't that the beauty of Instagram? Because we can photograph them from the good side and crop out the edges.
Yes, yes. And what's really interesting to me is at the same time that you applied for artisan status, your husband did too in miniature painting.
He did. He's an oil painter. And when I was working on dollhouses, he, just as a little gift one day, painted me a tiny little Picasso. And it was so wonderfully painted and well done. And he started doing it more frequently. And he's painted a whole collection. And so last summer, we decided to both submit our work. And of course, the submissions are done anonymously. You don't have your name on the work. So they didn't know who we were. And they certainly didn't know that we were married. But we were a little bit worried about it because I knew he was probably going to be accepted. He's a really great painter. And I was a little worried about my knitwear because it was a bit of a gamble. And I thought, well, what if he's accepted and I'm not? I'm going to be completely jealous.
Oh, that is hard. Because he didn't go to guild school. You did.
No, and he doesn't have an Instagram page focused on his paintings. He doesn't have any ego invested in his craft at all. He just enjoys making these paintings. And of course, he got in as well.
I feel like you need name tags, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Artisan.
Well, it's certainly fun to do something that I enjoy so much with my partner and to be able to craft and to sit at our kitchen table and each be making our miniatures. It's been a real cause and a source of joy in my life.
Now, like me, you started during the pandemic. Is that right?
I did. Yeah. Well, I did seriously as an adult in the pandemic, and I started taking it more seriously. But I did realize in this process that it wasn't actually the first time I had been interested in dollhouses and making miniatures.
You know what? That happens during every interview. I myself always said I started during the pandemic, but as I started talking, I realized all the crafts I'd made and all the dollhouses I had visited during my childhood. There's always a childhood connection.
Yeah, it's like a seed is planted early on, and then sometimes it just kind of lingers and is dormant before it fruits. My mom had a simple, kind of a small dollhouse that my dad had given to her as a gift, and I really was envious of that. And she let me play in it sometimes, and eventually she kind of gave it up to me, but I wanted a dollhouse of my own. So when I was a young teenager, I saved my babysitting money. And I went to the local craft store and they had these kits and I looked very carefully at them. It was really weighing this decision because I wanted the most rooms that I could get for my babysitting money.
I love that.
I bought this kit and it's the Art Ply Franklin. You can look it up. I've been looking, whenever I see someone making it now, I go, oh, I know that dollhouse. And I made this enormous monstrosity of a dollhouse.
How many rooms?
I think it was 9, 3 floors high and 3 floors wide. And it had like a little Romeo and Juliet balcony and a front porch. that I put plants on the front porch.
I mean, that's big.
It is. And it had a staircase. This is the thing that I usually notice about it. It has a staircase with a little space under the stairs, which I and a lot of other people love to turn into a little hallway, like a little broom closet under the stairs.
Oh, okay. A little Harry Potter room.
Yes. So there's an extra little room there.
So 10 rooms. You got 10 rooms for your babysitting money. And how did you make the furniture? Is it cardboard and things like that?
Yeah, I made some pretty rough cardboard pieces, like out of just box cardboard. Eventually, the house was given away to a younger cousin when I moved out, left this house at home. It was enormous. I always thought I might, once I got my real grown-up house, I might send for my dollhouse and set it up again, but that never happened. I know I bought some pieces. I loved poring over those catalogs from the late 80s, early 90s, where they have the, kind of very over-the-top floral, feminine furniture and things. I did buy some of the pieces, and I made pieces. I think it's like classic first dollhouse pieces. Like, I remember a lampshade and a waste paper basket that were both made out of the toothpaste, the fluted plastic toothpaste tube caps.
Classic. A classic.
Right? I think if you didn't start there, it's not even worth saying.
Even as an adult, the first thing I did is go and look at all my cosmetic, tops for planters and things like that.
But that's what happens when you work in miniature. You start looking at everyday items a little bit different, and everything takes on a different perspective when you're searching for something for your dollhouse. And that's still true today. So I laugh about my toothpaste tube caps, but I really do think that is the same attitude I have now when I'm looking at an odd piece of wire going, where could I use this? A visit to the hardware store will never be the same once you have a dollhouse. Yeah.
Never. Never. So you learned to sew at a very early age, you told me.
Yes, I did. My mother sewed. So she sewed for our family and made a lot of our clothing when I was small. So I was always making crafts from the time I can first remember. I was very young. And the funny thing about that is I remember trying to sew a little garment for a very small doll when I was really young. And at the time, I was sewing by hand, just holding a little needle that my mother would thread for me, and then I would sew. But I was trying to sew so close to the edge of a piece of fabric that it was fraying it. And it's a strange memory, because there's so often when today I'm trying to make something and my material won't let me get small enough. And that frustration I feel today is the same as I felt when I was this little child trying to sew things.
That's funny. And you were probably using some kind of ridiculous thick, like polyester double knit or something.
It was exactly that, polyester double knit. And I found recently a sample of that, which I shared with you, that we can share, this kind of fabric that I used to use for miniatures and for doll clothing that now I think is completely unsuitable material, but you use what you have at hand.
So you have a couple dollhouses, and they're all, do you have one that's 1/12?
I have one 1/12 scale dollhouse sort of started and then neglected. Mm-hmm. And the rest of them are all in 1/24 scale.
Wow. That is small. And so let's see, you have one that's kind of Americana.
Yes, that's the Fairfield that I've been working on for the last 2 years, kind of a Victorian farmhouse style house.
And that is the one with your amazing rug. This tiny little scrap of fabric that took forever, right?
A French knot rug. It's a French knot embroidery. So each little tuck of color is a little knot across the fabric, and it's a single strand of thread on a little needle.
Wow. So that's taken you about 2 years, and it's sort of finished?
Yeah. Now, that one was a really fun story, because it started on Instagram with a handful of people who also work in 1/24 scale invited me to join a group that was going to make the Fairfield house their project for 2022. And at first I was like, I don't think I really like that dollhouse kit, the shape or the style. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized I could, bring some of my own flavor and character and tastes to it. And then I joined them, and it turned out to be this wonderful project to do in community with other people all working on the same kit. And we were able to give each other moral support. And we met on video call once a month for a while. And we were chatting all the time about, what are you going to do? Well, what are you going to do with wallpaper? What are you going to do with your roof? And it was so much fun to build a dollhouse with other people, even though they were strangers all across the country and people that I had never met before.
As fun as it is to be a miniaturist and be holed up in your little room and do it by yourself, there is nothing like the joy of finding someone else who loves the same weird little thing that you love.
Well, it's funny because in the rest of your life, I think a lot of us just kind of put our hands over our mouth and are like a little bit quiet about saying, I'm a miniaturist or I really love my dollhouses.
Exactly. We talked about this. And so one of the joys of being, of talking to people on Instagram or going to Guild is that you can just break that silence, you know, without fear of ridicule.
It's wonderful.
And that's something else you and I have talked about, like this shame of like, why do we have to still defend our hobby?
Yeah. It's funny because I spent some time in art school and creativity and being creative is, you know, something I've always taken very seriously, but it's something about miniatures. And I think that's some of the self-consciousness that came into even naming my account Ridiculous Tiny Things was just kind of an announcement that I wasn't taking myself too seriously. But also there's this side of it that is so fun and silly underneath that kind of diminishment, that it has the power to tap into things that are really deeply held in people. Like, for example, when I hand someone one of my little miniature sweaters, I always love the reactions I get. But some people get really, really emotional about it even. And I handed one to a colleague one time, and he was just holding it like it was this most precious thing. And he told me a great story about how it reminded him of being a child and playing with his G.I. Joe dolls, which were dressable, and that feeling of creating an entire world. It just took him back to that childhood in a really powerful way. And I loved that moment. And I think it's just one of the most joyful things about miniatures is how they bring this magic in really unexpected ways that I think is quite serious and taps into something very human and very beautiful. It's ridiculous on the surface, but underneath that, it's actually quite wonderful.
Right. But I like how you were kind of trying to be like, well, you don't need to tell me it's ridiculous. I already know.
Right. I know that I spent 3 hours of my night making a coffee grinder that is half an inch tall. That is not a serious pursuit. Right. Preemptive defense. Exactly.
The preemptive defense. That's exactly what it is. So you have two other dollhouses, right?
I do. I have a little Moroccan house, which is only 4 rooms. That was a fun one of the early projects, but it's not finished. I'll come back to it. And same with the other house, which is my Paris house, which is another big one. It's still 1/24th scale, but it has lots of rooms because, again, just like my teenage self, I wanted to get all the rooms I could because I love imagining what each room can be and working a little bit here and a little bit there and coming back around. But none of them are really, they're all built. So the building is complete. They're constructed and they have electricity, but the decor and the furniture and the accessories, none of them is what I would consider a finished dollhouse.
Are they ever really finished?
I think I chose my dollhouses so that I wouldn't finish them because I like to think of them as, like, our real houses aren't usually finished. We change things every year. I might buy a new rug, I might add new curtains or get some different dishes. And you always change your collection and you're adding to your collection and building it. So I think of each of these houses as a place where, you know, part of my brain likes to live and likes to think about what to add next. And what would the people in this house buy? You know, what would they cook? What kind of food do I need for this house? Or what kind of rugs do I need or curtains? So that I'm in constantly thinking about what kind of collections the residents of these various houses would build.
And, you know, I think that was a surprise to me. When I started, I was like, I'm going to start this dollhouse and then I'm going to finish this dollhouse.
Oh.
It never occurred to me that I would keep working it and reworking it. It also didn't occur to me that I was going to get a second and a third.
How long until you looked at that first dollhouse and said, I don't know if I'm going to finish this one?
Well, I mean, it's finished. Uh-huh. I knew I would finish it. What I didn't realize was that after it's finished, I would keep working on it.
Right. I love the way that you say, well, it's finished, but I think that completely encapsulates the dollhouse experience.
Exactly. I didn't realize that once it was finished, I sort of thought I wasn't literally going to put glass on it, but in my mind, it was like glassed off and, you know, it wasn't an evolving thing.
Right.
And it was going to be like a painting. You don't do an oil painting, then walk by every day and add a little dab here and add a little dab there, right?
Right. That's true.
To me, it was going to be done, and then I would or would not do another one. But of course, I didn't understand anything about miniatures to think that, because I also wasn't thinking, you know, I'll be changing it up for seasons. And the first right. end table I made after right. I got better, I wanted a better end table. You know, none of that was in my mind somehow.
I think that's maybe where dollhouses, or for some of us and some of our dollhouses, they might live in an artistic space somewhat different from like miniaturists who do dioramas and scenes, because a dollhouse can be this space of continual ongoing change and reflection and growth and addition.
Yes, it started, you know, for me, it started with the seasons, and then I had my anniversary and I made a little mini wedding picture and a little mini bouquet, and then, well, it just evolved from there.
Right. And you put a lot of your real personal life into your dollhouses as well.
I do now. In the beginning, it really started out as sort of an interior decor exercise, I think. You know, my love of color, my love of design. But I think that's a process. You know, you start and then you realize how much you can personalize it. And the next project I hope to start, I keep waiting for the time, is my mother was an artist and she passed not that long ago. And I want to do like a gallery room for her.
Mm-hmm.
You just start thinking of more and more personal things.
Yes.
Becomes much more, I think, not really a journal, but a reflection of what you love in your life.
I think that's one of the most powerful aspects of this craft, and something I certainly didn't expect when I got into it. And I think a lot of this quote that another Instagram user that I've become friends with, her name's Laura, her account is Moth House Miniatures. And she said one time that dollhouses are a way of sharing something that we each know soul deep about sanctuary and belonging. And I think about your mother's, the project that you're doing about your mother and the way that that is so closely held and personal to you. And I think of the way that I work too, and some of the things I'm thinking about when I'm working. And I think there's a real vulnerability to that. Like, let me show you a space that I find beautiful, or an environment that I would feel welcome in, that I would want to welcome you. You've often spoken about how nice the people are in this community and how well everyone gets along. And I think this relates to it, that we all know intuitively that we're sharing something very intimate and vulnerable with one another. And it creates an environment of gentleness, because if you're sharing with me this experience of your mother's artwork, and I'm sharing with you some story about my own aesthetic and feelings about home and sanctuary and belonging, then it creates an environment in which we really nurture each other.
Oh, that's really beautiful. And that's a good explanation. I guess to me too, I thought of something you said the last time, where you said something about being a miniaturist is almost, and I don't remember in what context you said it, but the word subversive came up. And it really stuck with me. And I thought, it is a little subversive, because here we are, these grown people spending tons of time and talent and sometimes money and ideas and passion on these things that many people don't consider worthwhile. I mean, they're wrong, but
yes.
And there is something almost subversive about it. And I think it's that part of being such a small club and understanding something most people don't, that also makes us feel toward each other that we already understand something that other people don't.
For sure. I think there's so much subversiveness to it. For one thing, like, we're living in this world that is constantly sped up, and especially on social media, where everything is short clips of videos and reels and little short moments that are highly edited to package things. And then in our personal lives, here we are sort of hunched over tables working at things that are meticulous. They take time. You have to wait for the glue to dry, the paint to dry. You're, you know, bending a wire three different ways very carefully with tiny tweezers. And it can take hours to do something that is, you know, ridiculous and tiny. And it's almost like we're stopping that sped up clock of the world. And then in this community, we're like, we're looking at each other and we're literally watching each other's paint dry. We're like saying, oh, show me the steps of this process and the layers of material that you put together and show me how to do this. And so we're all sort of cumulatively holding back this force of speed by scaling down and taking our time on things.
It's funny you say that, because sometimes I will actually like show putting furniture in the dollhouse and then speed it up because no one wants to watch me do that for 20 minutes. And I always think it's so ironic. I think I must write in so many of my posts, like, if only it actually took this amount of time.
You know? Yeah, for sure.
But it always strikes me and you know, when I'm speeding all this up and like, quick, get it in. And it's like, well, that's not what it took to create this little tiny thing.
Right. It is a slow craft for sure.
And the glue drying, you know, that was really hard for me when I first started COVID, the glue drying. I actually would have to plan out another thing to do while the glue or paint dried, or I was like a 3-year-old, I would ruin it.
That's why you always have to have 6 projects going.
It is.
I spent a good part of today popping between a project where things had to dry and other projects. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's hard. So why so small?
Well, I know that I scaled down to 1/24 from 1/12 because of the size of the dollhouse overall. I had that big monstrous dollhouse of my teenage years and this idea that I could have that dollhouse if I wanted one. And I just never had a room big enough for it. And then in the pandemic, I started working on those kind of commercially available kits, the Rolife and the little room boxes that are 120. They're close to 1/24 scale. They're not exactly scaled. But when I did one of those projects, I realized that I could do this craft and it didn't need to take up an entire room. And I realized that there were entire dollhouses in this scale and dollhouse furniture in this. And I could have all the joy of a dollhouse without, you know, giving over an enormous space to it. I mean, it kind of turns out the joke's on me because I have, you know, 3 or 4 dollhouses instead of just one, but they do fit on a kitchen counter or on a bookshelf. So it's a way of being able to integrate the craft with the rest of my life.
Ah, so Julie, unlike a lot of the people that I interview, you actually don't sell any of your miniatures.
I don't. And it's one of the most frequently ask questions I get online is, you know, where do I sell my things? And so this is one of those areas, Becky, where I feel like I'm being subversive by not going along with kind of, I think, the norm. I think there's a lot of pressure that people get when they are making things or crafting to make it pay off, make it have a value in the world that the world is ready to accept. And there's a lot of pressure to commodify our craft and the time that we spend, especially if I'm going to spend all this time each week, you know, knitting something tiny or making rugs, that I've got to sell that time in some way. And I don't. And mostly it's for practical reasons that I work really slowly. I design these patterns myself for the knitwear in particular, and it takes a really long time. And then when I'm done with it, I'm ready to move on to the next project. I have so many ideas in my mind of what I want to make next, and to sit down and make another one, like if I was going to sell a few of them, just bores me. Like it feels like, you know, filling in yesterday's crossword puzzle. Like I already did that. I don't want to sit and do it again. So I want to just keep moving forward. It's a part of the way that I hold on to this as a thing that is for myself and for my own personal joy and for my creativity, and trying to make a space where I want to live a creative life, exercising my creative muscles without feeling the need to write a business plan, write a marketing plan, and really commodify it.
And isn't it interesting how we do feel the need to justify what we do? And I think everyone feels it to some extent, but I do think women feel that a little more.
I do too. I think for sure that it's gendered if you have a pastime. And I think there's also something about the act of making, that if we make something, it should be a thing that has function. And I'll tell you, there's nothing less functional than a sweater that can fit your pinky finger.
So one of the husbands of my friend, who's also my friend, he said to me recently, you know, so are you finished with miniatures? Are you done? Do you have them all?
Oh. Uh-huh.
And I was like, well, you collect wine. Are you finished?
Oh, right.
Do you have all the wine? He's like, no, of course not. You'll never have all the wine. And I was like, right. That's how I feel. And it really struck him. He really didn't see the similarity at first. You know, he somehow in his mind there was a finite, you know, you got one miniature table, you're done.
Right. I mean, wine is a really good comparison because there's this sense of adventure and you know, searching and finding with wine. You want wine from different territories, you want one with different varieties. And it's the same when collecting miniatures. And I think it's also the same when making, like, I want to know if I can make this thing. Okay, then I can or I can't, you know, I might have some measure of success. And then I want to try my hand at another thing. And it's really just for that breadth and diversity of effort, essentially.
We go on a lot of little trips. And so I like to get miniatures from different trips. Or sometimes they're not miniatures. Sometimes it'll be a seashell or a fabric.
Mm-hmm.
Just like people go and buy wine, you know, to remind themselves of visiting different regions.
That was one of the greatest discoveries as a pandemic miniaturist, where I really focused on this during lockdown. It was such a revelation when I first was able to travel to find after the pandemic. And then I found that, you know, the world was full of miniatures, essentially, that I could look at things through this different perspective and look for materials, just as you say, or look for, you know, shops that are selling miniatures or makers in other places, and just enjoying this hobby in a new and different way.
I know I often find, as I'm going through the week, that I'll say, oh, well, obviously I have to, you know, run this errand first, and then I can make a mini.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw this meme like a couple months ago, and like a lot of internet memes, it's kind of cliche, but there's some truth to it. And it said, you were not just put on this earth to do errands, clean the house, and lose weight.
Right, exactly.
And that really, I mean, I guess I'm a little embarrassed that an internet meme made me think about my life. But it did, okay?
Practicing creativity regularly in our life expands our well-being, expands our mental health, expands our connection to the world, and we wouldn't feel the need to commodify that. Like, if I was really good at a sport, people would understand that, you know, like, say, Julie really enjoys volleyball. I don't know how much pressure I would get for being like, oh, you need to go pro and be a professional volleyball player. It's like, we understand that that's not very realistic. And I think the life as a full-time paid miniaturist is also not very realistic, but it doesn't mean I don't enjoy it and that I don't want to engage in it in the same way, and that it's making me a stronger, healthier, more well-rounded person, the same as athletic activity or exercise.
You know what? I just got an idea. What we need is a way to quantify it. Like, my husband and I love to walk, and we love to see how much we walk.
Oh, 10,000 steps for miniaturists.
Yes. I mean, my husband, if he leaves his watch off and he walks 3 miles, he's devastated that he didn't get credit. Devastated. You know, we both want like a little appeal where you can write that in. You know, I left it behind.
Do need this. The Apple Watch can track our miniature work each week.
We can say, I spent 30 minutes a day. You know, like they say, take a moment to, you know, be mindful. I want them to track our creativity. I want creativity points, Apple.
Did you get your weekly creativity in?
Exactly. Yes. I feel like if we could quantify it, people would start being like, oh, I have to get that in.
The same as we get in our water or our vegetables. Yes.
Exactly. And instead of steps, it could be, I don't know, hand movements or how much glue you used or something.
That would be a great metric. Have you knitted today?
Have you knitted today? You know, something like that. Maybe that's another thing in this our society. If we feel like we have to quantify it, and if somehow we can make a chart, then it's worthwhile.
Well, that's true too, because then it introduces the level of competition too.
Yes, but maybe we can take making things into well, of course you got to make things every week. That's good for you. That's what people should do.
Exactly. There will be whatever the miniaturist alternative would be to a gym, places where you can go and make dollhouses in public.
In public. And not have people say, why do you do that?
Because people will just understand that it's healthy for us.
Exactly. Exactly. But I am thinking of writing to Apple about the creativity. I do think I need a little graph for that, don't you think?
We need a health tracker. Yes.
Yeah.
We need an art health tracker.
An art tracker. I like that. That's a really good thing.
Have you arted today?
I like that. Art is good for your heart or something. I don't know.
Yes.
We'll workshop that a little. We need to workshop that a little. So do you have big plans this year for any miniature projects or, well, any little plans, I should say?
Big and little. Yes, I have some sweaters in my mind that I'm really looking forward to knitting and starting to plan. I also am going to move on to another dollhouse. There's always one more. So it's like I've heard that gardeners say this a lot. People who have beautiful gardens always say that their best garden is the one that they will grow next year.
Oh.
And I think that's the same with dollhouses. In our mind, it's the next one is going to be the best one.
You know what? You've really tapped into something. I know for me, I definitely feel that way. Yes, it's like I'm going to reach the summit, you know?
Right.
The Mount Everest.
Exactly. I've learned so much on this project. I'm going to apply it to the next one.
I do see a progression of my dollhouses. And I do, occasionally I'll go back to the very first post I made on Instagram and I just laugh so hard. You know, I want to thank the 100 people who liked it because it was truly, it was truly an act of love and giving that you did so. You know?
That's really sweet.
Because it was just, you know, but you know, at the time I was proud of it. It was the best I could do. That's what I love, that people met me there. You know, and that's not where many of them were. They were beyond that. But I love that they met me there and they didn't say, hey, girl, you can do better.
Well, that's another component of this community that I really appreciate. I love when people share like their work from maybe a year ago or 2 years ago, and then they're the same item made over again, because it's so encouraging when you can see that you can start with something and become good at it in a relatively short period of time. So I really like sharing that myself, and also when other people share that progress as well. I think it also keeps me honest and humble, because when I was first trying to knit in miniature and I was sharing those results on my Instagram stories, I have still kept those stories in a highlight. And so people can see my very awkward initial attempts. And I think that's really important for someone who's just getting started to see that you're not an expert when you begin. You have to go through a beginner phase where everything you touch looks really clunky and uneven.
In the fairness of full disclosure, you were already an experienced knitter.
I was. Yeah. Scaling it down is an exercise on its own. And some of those early pieces, I like to keep them in the same box with my sweaters too, so I can look at them. They're hilarious. You know, really uneven rows, wonky edges, all the rough things of a beginner knitter. And that's where you have to start.
Now, you do mini crochet. Which do you prefer, the crocheting or the knitting?
Oh, that's a hard question. They both have their functions. I think knitting, that's a really hard question. I mean, knitting is sort of my native language, I guess.
Right. The crocheting came later, right?
The crocheting actually came at guild school last summer. Now, I crocheted in full scale, but again, shrinking it to miniature is an entirely different endeavor. And I took a crochet class at guild school in Maine, and I had Mariella Vitale was my teacher. I had the most wonderful class, and she shared just enough tips and tricks, like even just simple things like how to hold the thread, where I had to learn this all over again, essentially, even as a practiced needle crafter, and what materials to use. And it made all the difference and it became really fun. And I've been doing it since last summer.
You know, when we were in guild school, I was a little like being back in college or camp, because you and I would a couple nights stay up late and talk about the meaning of the world and mini crochet.
It was so much fun. It was so much fun to meet like minds and also to share a room with you. Yes.
We had so much fun. We really, really did. And, you know, I think to me, Guild School was about learning things I never would have learned and even being able to try equipment. But it was also about that meeting of the minds in that community.
For sure.
So, yeah, so we're going to put some of your work up so everyone can see it, all the little bears and all the knitted sweaters. Make sure you have your contacts or your glasses on, people, because when she says ridiculously tiny, she's not kidding around. It's tiny and delightful, and it just unlocks something in me that gives me some joy. I want to feel that joy every day, and I want to get to a place where I don't have to justify spending time on things that bring me joy.
I'm definitely right with you, Becky. I'm here for the joy.
Yes, we're all here for the joy. Well, on that note, go create something joyful and tiny, and thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Becky.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
I hope you enjoyed talking to Julie as much as I did. She is so talented, and I just loved hearing her perspective on miniatures. Coming up in April is an interview with the amazing Era Bentley. Era is famous for her YouTube videos, from her creation of the Addams Family Mansion in miniature to the cardboard house, complete with toilet paper fairy during COVID, and her recent project, building the Beetlejuice house in miniature. Stay tuned on my Instagram to find out when in April that interview is coming out. In the meantime, remember, there are no rules in your dollhouse except for the ones you create for yourself. Goodbye.